The Grade Cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grey Cricketer Podcast on Fox Sports. Wow, it's happening. It's actually happening. James Sutherland is on the show. It's an absolute honour and a privilege to have the CEO of Cricket Australia on the show today. And hopefully the throwdowns we provide will whet the appetite much in the same way the first test just around the corner at the Gabba does to us all. Izzy Westbury from the UK is on the phone to tell us what's going on with the England squad, the result of the women's Ashes at North Sydney Oval over the weekend. Elise Perry's 213, now the greatest double hundred scored by Perry on that ground. Australia's squad is announced on Friday. Do we know anything more than we did a month ago? And what, if anything, does any of this mean? We'll answer all of your questions in hashtag AskTGC and some of the ones that you didn't. My name is Ian Higgins. I'm joined, as ever, by Sam Perry and Dave Edwards. Boys, we only have to fake it for another 7 days because the first test is a mere week away.
Yeah, I'm feeling it, Higgos. I'm really starting to feel the excitement, but also some irony in my voice there as well. It still just has been another week of making up stories just to keep the whole thing going. But when we talk next week, the Ashes will be imminent. Even so, we should do well today. And I liked how you said, Higgos, that... what does any of this mean? Because we're continuing the postmodern theme from last week. You know, postmodern, what about Renshaw, the ultimate modernity last year, and now he's on the nose, as they say. Is he going to play?
Well, we don't know, do we, Pez? I mean, we're going to have to wait till a Friday, I think it is, when the test side is announced. But, I mean, look, Bancroft is hitting runs. We're talking about Bancroft now. There's been a bat off. Renshaw was involved in a bat off. I'll avoid the easy joke there. He had a 45
hour. I think he got a bit of it in.
He had a 45 minute net session this week against Stark, Cummings, Hazelwood, and Bird. And I believe this was watched intensely by Lehman, and maybe even Pat Howard was hiding behind the net somewhere watching it as well, voyeuristically. So much scrutiny around Renshaw. Is he going to open? I mean, he only hit 180 in his last test match in Australia, but that was a year ago. Is that recent form? What do runs even mean? What does any of this mean?
Can we go just back a minute, get back onto Renshaw by just highlighting that I think you just said Pat Cummings. I think you did it.
Did I?
I think you put the G in. I think you put the G in the Cummings.
I apologise profusely for the slip of the tongue there. It's Pat Cummins. I know this. Everyone knows this. And again, public apologies from my behalf. But can we move on and just get back onto the Renshaw topic, if possible?
Yeah,
thank
Renshaw.
You, guys.
Yeah, Renshaw. I mean, as you rightly point out, Dave, he faced the four-pace prong attack. Geez, that's hard to say. Of Bird, Hazelwood, Stark, Pat Cummins as well. And as you say, Pat Howard was there. Darren Buff Lehman was there. Renshaw just battling balls in the nets. And they reckon that he's going to play. They reckon he's going to play now.
Must have been a good net. Must have been a seriously good net.
You know how in the nets when like you just get a half-timed cover drive and it just flies into the net and everyone says, shot, mate.
But you don't know what the ball's done past the net. Like, it gets to the net, and you just have to envisage where the ball's gone. Like, has it pierced the field beautifully? Was the timing good? Like, what are the acoustics of the net? Maybe it wasn't that good a shot. There's so many things you have to consider.
It's actually the opposite of, like, when you mistime a cover drive and it looks like it's flown, like, for four, and you didn't even quite get that one. But then the one that you bomb directly straight out of the net for no reason, not because you would never hit a straight six in a match. You just do it because you want to see the parabolic arc, and then you can walk down the net and go walk past Nathan Lyon or whoever you've just hit, and you can just say didn't even get it. So it's all net politics.
I think that's the same thing that Mitchell Stark said when he got a twin hat trick or whatever they call it. Didn't even get it. Well, you did, even though you've described yourself as not even the best bowling you've ever performed.
I'm curious about this Renshaw net, because I, as the listeners know, I'm in London, so I woke up this morning and tried to scan the news for what had happened in the last day of Shield cricket, and part of that is going on the very impressive cricket.com.au website, and I'm not saying that because James Sutherland's on later and we're just in their pockets now. We're not at all open, though. But the first article on cricket.com.au was not about what had happened in the actual Sheffield Shield cricket, but this net that Matt Renshaw had after the game. And, like, I have a slightly different take on it when I thought about that. I thought, how, like, scary would that net be when you've literally played a match against the opposition for 4 days prior? They'd skittled you. Your name is being bandied about as someone who's going to be possibly dropped. You're 20, and now you have to face a test attack in the nets while a coach and Pat Howard looks on. It's possibly the worst audition of all time, isn't it?
It's also an audition against your mates. Like, your mates are trying to get you out. Like, that's just cricket in a nutshell, isn't it? Like, you kind of play against your teammates. You play with them, but you play against them as well. And these guys, their modus operandi is to make Renshaw, you know, put him in all sorts and essentially make sure he doesn't play in the first test. Conflicted
feelings.
You know
how in The Lion King, when Simba sings that song, I Can't Wait to Be King, but then he's sad when Mufasa dies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
This is the same thing as that.
Yeah, he definitely wants to be king, doesn't he? He definitely wouldn't pass that opportunity down if it arises, and does.
The thing about Matt Renshaw, though, is that he's only 20.
Yeah, I that factors in my thinking a lot about Renshaw. Like, I was a big Renshaw man until the other day. And one thing that... seriously, like, I think it would be really difficult for someone like him at age 20, who is clearly in a form slump, possibly a major one as well, to fix that under the microscope that he will be under. It's likely he's never been in a major form slump in his life. And to try and do that in the midst of an Ashes series, possibly the biggest one, the biggest set of test matches that have been in this, you know, in Australia for 4 years since the last one, is a monumental task for him. I wonder whether it would almost be in his interests to not play, as counterintuitive as that sounds, particularly when you have another guy, an opening batsman, who cannot stop scoring runs and has been kind of fated for a while anyway. In Bancroft, you know, batting is a strange art, and he's got a couple of demons now, Renshaw, and, you know, it just would be really difficult to fix at this point, especially if it's bad.
So, okay, lads, then what about the number six position? We're still none the wiser there. No one's really scored enough runs in any of these Shield matches. I mean, the ball has definitely dominated, and it even did so in the CA11 game against England as well, the Adelaide Oval, another day-night match. Number six, though, Maxwell versus Cartwright seems to be the two options there. Who are you fancying? Who are you seeing? Who are you looking at?
He goes, I feel like this is one of those situations where, like, you have to hire someone that you're not 100% comfortable with. Like, you know, you've got to fill the role. There's a couple of candidates. Maybe one guy came across pretty smug in the interview. You know, there's maybe another guy who's like a huge glaring gap in his resume from 2012 to 2014. What did he get up to? You don't know. But he came across well in the interview. But ultimately, you need to fill the role because it's not business as usual otherwise. You need to fill this role, otherwise business will be affected. So it's a difficult one for the selectors. No one's a lock for this position. But you can't just not fill it and save money. Yeah, we'll just let it go for 6 months and won't fill it. Like, you have to have a number six batter in the middle of the order. So they have to pick someone. There's maybe not any one person who's perfectly right for the role. And I still maintain my queries over what a number six is anyway. But if it's Maxwell v. Bancroft, and I think that's what we're kind of talking about at the moment.
Well, Cartwright as well.
Sorry, Cartwright. Maxwell. Jeez, I don't even know anymore. I don't have an opinion. I'm not paid to have opinions.
Sam Perry, what was Glenn Maxwell doing between the years 2012 and 2014?
So I was trying to fit in the gaps of who was whom there when Dave was talking about the interview people.
Which one's Simba?
Yeah, I think Maxwell's definitely the person with the gap from 2012 to 2014 when he was sort of saying that he could reverse sweep as comfortably as others could cover drive.
Yeah, it's
and
like
now
my
he's
cover
trying
drive.
To severely repair his reputation. But yeah, I'd probably be inclined to stick with Maxwell, but I think that they might actually plump for Cartwright because they love him a lot and they also are very set on the idea that that sixth batsman has to bowl seam up, even though Cartwright doesn't bowl, which is so it's completely illogical. Or when he does, it's terrible. with respect.
Ricky Hilton, Ponting, if you're listening, has backed Hilton Cartwright to fill that number six position. And I put it down to, I don't know if you guys remember this. It was against Pakistan, the SCG test match, a dead rubber test match. Cartwright came in at four for, I think, Australia 1,075. And he hit his first ball in test cricket, just the most perfect cover drive for four. Oh. And if you're telling me that's not going to get him a berth in the first test match, then you don't know cricket.
The way he, I still remember that cover drive. He goes, like, it's painted on my memory. And it was just the product of ball machine after ball machine growing up in Australian cricket. Hard wickets, all angles, elbows straight, front dogging it.
The front dogging almost sounds like a sexual position, doesn't it? But, and I wonder how, oh no, is that libel? I was just going to say, Greg Chappell must have felt very good when Hilton Cartwright played that cover drive, because that would have been the manifestation of Australian cricket policy in one shot. Yeah. You know, this big, chesty, new guy with a baby face looking massive, hitting a cover drive for four of his first ball.
Oh, my God, it's Shane Watson all over again. Baby face with tights and just levers.
And he's sponsored by Juggs, the ball machine. All right, lads, wicketkeeper, Wade Neville Bancroft, who are you going for? Who do you fancy?
This is really interesting, he goes. I don't have a an industrial relations metaphor like Dave, but I feel like if they change the opener, then they might, and they bring in Cartwright as six, they might be reluctant to make another change away from Wade. I mean, I can't see why Matt Wade should be picked with respect to him. But I think that's one of the things in Wade's favour. If it's not Wade, it has to be Peter Neville, doesn't it? And I also think that it would be a pretty big ask to debut Cam Bancroft as a batsman who keeps as well. It's got to be one.
Absolutely. I mean, Wade, not the best keeper, not the best batsman. Neville, arguably the best keeper of the three, not the best batsman. Bancroft, arguably the best batsman, never kept. You know, he doesn't keep that much. So, look, I think, we're going to probably lean towards Neville, aren't we? But we just want everything in one player. Ever since Gilchrist, I think we just need to accept that there's no such thing as the perfect man. The perfect man doesn't exist.
John Eales. I don't know if you guys caught this on the cricket.com.au Twitter feed, but they showed Peter Siddle, actually, forgotten quick in many ways. Peter Siddle bowling his former Victorian teammate, Matt Wade. He bowled him with a pull shot, and the hashtag used was Jaffa. I don't know if that ball could be described as a Jaffa when you get bowled playing a pull shot. Thoughts?
Well, I think it was an exceptionally poor shot. I mean, I guess it did hit the stumps. Mm. So it's doing something right. And I would also dispute that he's a forgotten quick if you're in Melbourne or Victoria, because SIDS is all they talk about.
Yeah, Vics do it better, don't they?
Guys, I want to ask you just quickly, just this. I mean, this is off the agenda, but I'm just looking at the Australian lineup, and you've got the names who are definitely there, Warner, Khawaja, Smith and Hanscom. And I was kind of thinking, Hanscom hasn't really impressed so far, has he? I mean, he hasn't really... I mean, he's obviously played most of his test matches thus far in the subcontinent, which is a hard place to bat for anyone. But to me, he hasn't really done that well. But then I look at those other names, and Khawaja averages 60 in Australia. Warner is likely to score seven second innings hundreds this Ashes series in five test matches. Steve Smith averages a million in Australia. So all these guys can just bat in Australia, can't they? And that's what we want. We just want to bat in Australia.
I think Hanscom will eventually... Sorry. Yeah.
That's the brief. Guys, we just want you to bat in Australia.
I think Hanscom belongs among those guys. I think he'd be mates with them. I think they'll have accepted him by now. He did play a few good innings overseas, but as we know, if it didn't happen at home, it never happened. And I think he averages pretty high at home as well. So.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he'll be okay. But yeah, just be good in Australia and just make us happy and help us remember what things were like when things were good. And that's all we ask.
Bradman, he was good. Guys, I don't know if you've noticed this, but this time of year is just Christmas for ex-players. And of course, that sort of generation of like the really good Australian team of the early 2000s and late 90s, this is their time to come out and just say, remember when I used to play? Have you noticed that? Like, there's just a lot of... sure, a lot of these guys get asked specifically for their opinions and they're completely entitled to give it. This is a podcast from three great cricketers who've done nothing, contributed nothing to the game. But, like, you know, there's just like these really strong opinions, and it just screams to me, remember when I used to play?
Oh, the relevance factor goes through the roof, doesn't it? It's not just restricted to cricket. It's like ex-politicians on election day on Sky News, like Graham Richardson banging on about Hawke and Keating and what it was like in Labor in the 90s. People just love to be asked for opinions of what they were like, you know, back in the day. And as you say, this is Christmas time for former Test greats.
But I lap it up too. You know, if you're a producer and you you know, you were looking for comments, surely you'd go to the people who did content. Well. When they were, I lap it all up because it just reminds me of how good people were and how good things used to be. And I think the players do as well. I did notice that a lot of the players' comments are very geared along state lines, though, as well. Like, there's this kind of strange, like, state parochialism happening in the last week or so. So I saw Justin Langer plumped for Cam Bancroft, and like Langer coached Renshaw over the off season while Lehman was away. So he's plumped for Bancroft, but then Matt Hayden, you know, his partner, his great partner in crime and sometime lover, that's a joke. said that's wrong, and Renshaw should get the nod. And then Steve Waugh has plumped for Moses Henriques from New South Wales.
Yeah,
Brad Hodge is plumped. Everyone's plumping here for Glenn Maxwell.
Everyone's plumping.
Nothing for Wade, though, actually. Ricky Ponting plumped for Neville. Nothing for Wade.
He crossed the floor on Wade.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with it, Pez. I mean, look, states are self-interested actors. I mean, if I learnt nothing else in international relations at university, it's that. I mean, I just think they're going to back their state, aren't they?
Is that what you thought when the lecturer was talking about state? He thought about Shield cricket.
I thought about Shield cricket when Gil Meron was up there.
Nothing for Wade, though.
In World Politics 101, Sydney University.
States are international actors. Oh, how does that play into terrorism? Well, like the fortunes of Queensland cricket.
Who's going to subscribe to the realist paradigm?
Isn't this, though, like, I'm sure, I know for a fact that, you know, the current state representatives obviously care deeply about the Sheffield Shield or the JLT Cup and the JLT Shield and everything else they do. But, like, I feel like the state representatives, it meant a lot more, you know, representing your state meant a lot more to you know, Justin Langer, Steve Waugh, Matthew Hayden, because they played a lot more for their state. You know, they played, like, almost full seasons, these guys, whereas now, you know, Steve Smith, Dave Warner, they played two games at the beginning of the year, then they fuck off back to a camp where they hit some more balls in a net.
And they generally played for their state throughout their career. Like, they didn't hop around, did they? They were true blue to their state from ball one throughout their entire career. So they do retain that parochialism. And, you know, Justin Langer, of course he's going to do that, isn't he, JL?
All right, lads. The women's Ashes is a thing that's been going on, and the Test match was a roaring success at North Sydney Oval. I was actually a party to the crowd on Friday evening. It was absolutely fantastic. I think there was about 3,500 people there Friday afternoon after work. Rolled down there, a couple of mid-strength lagers, and it was absolutely sensational. Australia were in a bit of trouble, actually. England got, I think, about 270, and then the end of the day's play that I saw, day two, Australia were 4 for 100. Elise Perry was at the crease, 70 not out overnight, racks up her first century the following day on Saturday, and then goes on to complete a stunning double century, 213 not out. Pez, you also have the last name of Perry, and you scored a double 100 on North Sydney Oval.
Number two.
Let's make this about you.
Number two. Yeah, look, not the first Perry to score a double ton in the North Sydney precinct, I would say, but one was against Blacktown second grade, and the other one was against England, and that one against England wasn't mine. Like I've said, I've always had a problem with Elise Perry, because every time I've wanted to Google myself and cricket and I click images, it's just pictures of Elise Perry. So Pez, while it's, you know, it's good to share your name, you've pretty much stolen most of the hours of day at work and what I would normally do there. But no, seriously, I do have some strange pride in her scoring hundreds, and it, you know, you see all those headlines saying Perry tons up, or Perry saves the day, or Perry's the greatest. I just block out the Elise bit and just look at it for probably
too
long.
It's just like newspaper clippings that you just wish related to you, that you, if only. I mean, what's the deal with the, it's like a weird multi-format system, isn't it? There's T20s, one days, and test matches, and they're kind of added up.
Yes, that's right.
Where does it sit at the moment?
So Australia is 6-4 ahead. Yeah, sorry, Paz. I was going to say Australia is 6-4 ahead. Yeah. The T20 start this Friday again at North Sydney Oval. I'm expecting a packed crowd. I think already 5,000 tickets sold for the T20 North Sydney Oval this coming Friday, tomorrow when this comes out. So the series is poised. Australia just needs one more win to reclaim the Ashes because they hold it from last time. So the series is poised. Did you guys take much in from the women's test match?
I did. It got a lot of coverage over here in England as well. A funny thing that happens with English cricket here is, like, I go into work of any kind of weekday and Sky Sports is on. And when England are doing well against Australia in any match, they'll run the highlights overnight of what they were doing that day. When they're not doing well in the match, they just run 2005 highlights on Sky Sports. I didn't see a lot. But one thing I did notice, to relate it back to grade cricket, Heather Knight, I believe, was on 79 not out when they called a halt to play because they couldn't get a result, even though there was a bit of time to go. And I was a bit disappointed from a grade point of view that she didn't just carry on, even though the match was effectively over, and just keep everybody out there while she chased a personal milestone. I thought that would have been very good and appropriate on the grade cricket ground that is North Sydney Oval.
Is there anything worse in cricket than that? Just waiting for the inevitable. Just you're so close to it being over, yet someone is chasing glory. You've already lost, and there's absolutely nothing you can do about it. Nothing more emasculating.
That's when you see the worst of humanity, because that's when you hear the worst sledges, when the game is already defeated. It's past like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Everyone's knackered. The game is lost. And then there's always a guy in his early to mid-30s, and he just loses it. What the fuck are we still doing out here? You're fucking keeping us out here.
It gets angry,
just that,
doesn't
just
it?
Just that kind
gets
of
real
and
angry.
And he sounds like that as well. Yeah. Gets real angry.
And then there's no handshakes after the game. It's just cold shoulders everywhere. And
fuck these blokes.
It's not good.
I know exactly what you mean. In one of my very first... Just talking about myself here, but very first grade games, and I just mentioned that because I was very no, that sounds wrong, but I'm saying it because it was a very special moment for me, and I was very proud to be there, and I didn't belong there, as my cricket stats will eventually show. But my dad was there and stuff. We got absolutely hammered by Penrith, Pat Cummins' club side, though. He was about 12 at the time, and they chased 250. And one down at Howell Oval, if anyone from Sydney knows Howell Oval, is the most unforgiving ground in the west of Sydney that exists. And they passed us one down, but they decided to keep going because they were chasing a club record, these two batsmen. I think one of them might have been Jordan Silk. And I was like, okay, well, the game's still on and you've got to try your best and all that kind of stuff. Not our team. All these older guys... made such a mockery of this that some of them started coming in to bowl round the wicket with their opposite hand that they bowl within a first grade fixture. Some of them, as protest, sat down. Literally sat down on the field. Like, this isn't park cricket. This is grade cricket at this club, North Sydney. Guys bowling the wrong hand sitting on the ground.
You've told me about this story before.
Yeah.
And just none of it surprises me.
Yeah, particularly at that club. Hello, any bears listening out there? And I just thought, wow, for all of the work that had been put in to get to that level, for it to be reduced to something even worse than park cricket says it all about chasing personal milestones when the game's over.
In my mind, Pez, you're still you still have zinc across your face. You have the speed dealer sunglasses. You're still walking with a bowler, encouraging. Yeah, try harder. Pitch it up. Yeah, Izzy Westbury coming up.
Oh, look, I haven't changed my point of view on the matter. I said what I said a few years ago, and I guess at the moment he's obviously trying to sell a book, so it's amazing how more and more of the story comes out.
So are you two mates?
I think that's a bit of a stretch to say that we're mates.
Well, that's certainly what he's been saying.
Yeah, look, I think, as I said before, it's a bit of a stretch of the imagination, given that we've hardly spoken about since it all happened, and obviously haven't played since he took over as captain. But anyway, that's all old news now. So as I said, I think it's more about him trying to promote his book through the summer.
Hell, when will it end?
Boys, a very special cricket writer joins us today, one from the UK. We have on the line with us Izzy Westbury, BBC sports commentator and I didn't mention this earlier when we were talking off air, recently anointed Domestic Broadcaster of the Year in the UK at the ECB Journalism Awards. Izzy, thank you for joining The Great Cricketer again. Why have you decided to do this?
Goodness gracious me. What an introduction. I guess I played great cricket and then it's better than the English version, isn't it, really?
Because you spent some time in
so
Melbourne.
So you played great cricket in Australia. You're familiar with our work, with the sport.
I played at Paran for a couple of seasons. That's how they say
it,
right?
I bet you wanted to call it Paran. You would have desperately wanted to call it Paran.
Before I came over, I was looking at this ridiculous spelling and trying to work out what on earth it was. But Paran is apparently the way it goes.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find it there?
Oh,
you
I loved
it. Como Park? Como Park would have been your home ground? Or perhaps Toorak over number
Toorak,
one?
Toorak Park. Absolute
sorry.
Road.
You're a very good cricketer. Toorak number one
I
for you.
Oh, yeah. Or Rugetti Oval, that was a good place to go. At least the ball actually spun there. I mean, I heard about spinners coming to die in Australia, but bloody hell. Yeah, that was a bit unfortunate one.
But
it's a good team. It's a good team. And some good players there. I mean, the only awkward thing, I guess, was that, well, I think your esteemed guest just before you, his daughter, who's about, I don't know, 10 years younger than me, could both bowl and bat better than I could. And if you talk about his son, Will, coming through, Annabelle, she's better than Elise Perry. She's scared already.
Ooh. Headline. Clickbait.
Well, yeah, you're referring to James Sutherland there, who we've got coming up next on the show. So, Izzy, you're obviously an excellent cricketer. You played with Middlesex as well in the UK, a little bit of England Academy stuff, as far as I understand, and now you commentate with the BBC. You'd obviously know a lot of the a lot of the guys playing in the Women's Ashes at the moment would have been probably teammates of yours or people you've played against. You know, like, how do you see their prospects going into the final three T20s, you know, where the whole Ashes are up for grabs?
I guess, I mean, I'd hope it would be fewer guys and more girls playing in the women's Ashes.
Yes, I said it and I thought that was...
to be honest, like, they've been punching a bit. England winning the World Cup, and actually I thought it was a bit of a surprise, and coming over to Australia. Australia made quite a few mistakes, I think, in the World Cup. The bowling was a bit terrible. And you sorted that out. And then home grounds, home crowds as well. And when you've got, you know, one woman that only scores centuries when it's a double hundred against the English, then you've got a bit of a hiding to nothing. I think Australia have to remain the favourites. They're going in with, what, a 4-point advantage. And traditionally, I guess, it's also Australia's strongest suit. They're sort of three times world T20 winners going into the last one. They got beaten by West Indies in a bit of an anomaly. I've got to back Australia, really, here, being realistic. Mm. Having said that, we've got a few of our own superstars. Sarah Taylor, she can do a little bit with the bat. Nat Siver, we saw what she could do at the World Cup. So, a bit deferential, a bit English there, saying Australia. Mm. But, yeah, that's the way it is.
Okay. So there's no... I mean, you don't, like, have text messages being exchanged with the girls saying, we can do this. I mean, the reason I'm asking is because Australia, both in men and women, is priming themselves for a hyper-aggressive, comprehensive beating of England. And I say beating deliberately because the hashtag is Beat England. So I'm just trying to find out whether
we
can...
You could have done better there.
I agree.
I mean, of all the things you could come
up
with...
No, he couldn't.
Evidently you couldn't. Well, let's hope it gets better on the pitch. But my goodness, that was one to go for. Beat England. God, it's like Elisa Healy behind the stumps just chirping away. I think Catherine Brunt has better chat than you lot altogether.
How many people are in Cricket Australia's media team? 300?
Yeah.
400? Beat England.
What, I worked for Cricket Australia's media team back in the day when I came over. Yeah. I was covering the BBL and the WBBL, but that was an experience. Once in a lifetime, perhaps.
I'm just picking up on your comment there, Izzy, about Elisa Healy and chirping behind the stumps. I mean, does she have a reputation for being fairly chirpy? And, you know, how would she compare to, say, Matt Wade, as far as you understand?
I don't think she says Gary quite eloquently. But yeah, I think the Aussies are known for having a bit of a chat behind the stumps. Elisa especially, if she could, you know, convert that to some runs with a bat, I think that would be a bit better for her.
Oh, let's score some runs before you chat.
Yeah.
You know what? You know what? I think this summer we've had in England just gone and the World Cup, and now with the Ashes, this is a real turning point in women's cricket. Because before, the coverage of women's cricket used to be like, oh, yeah, we're covering women's cricket. How great are we? Whereas now it's really turned into like a competition and a spectacle in its own right. And I think for me, the turning point was that England versus Australia match in Bristol in the World Cup, when before you'd have had sort of dutiful fathers bringing their daughters with them because they felt as though it was the right thing to do to watch these women. But now it was like, oh no, we're playing Australia. We want to thump them. We want a good spectacle. We want to beat the Aussies. And I think you're getting that feeling now in Australia. I was listening to the Tuffers and Vaughan stuff last night on the BBC, and they were saying, I think it was Sophie Eccleston, who's our young spinner, she's only 18, and apparently the crowd at the North Sydney Oval were absolutely hammering it into her down at third man. So I think there's a real sense of, right, we want to beat you lot. It's not just happy chappies watching women's cricket.
So Izzy, are you saying that cricketing abuse is a form of progression in the game?
if you can call it that, yeah, let's go with that. I mean, in the World Cup final, my sort of standard bearer for, right, women's cricket has now reached the big time, is that there were ticket touts outside Lords. Ticket touts of women's cricket. Well, I never thought I'd see that day.
In my defence, I full-length beers, and I didn't realise Sophie was 18 years old. So, you know, I apologise for the things that I said to her when she was standing at third man. I want to ask you, Izzy, because I want to compare everything to the greatest moment ever. And I just need to know everything. And that Amanda Wellington, her ball to Tammy Beaumont, is that the greatest ball that's ever been bowled in cricket? Because it was amazing.
Shane Warne who? I mean, geez. No, it's not. I tell you why not, because I saw the first time I saw her was playing in the WBBL, and she was this chirpy little kid that sort of came on. I think she was playing for Strikers, and she bowled Meg Lanning around the legs. And from then on, you're like, well, this is it. The problem there, it wasn't caught on camera. Yeah, she can turn it a bit, and she's got a bit of attitude as well, a spunky little character.
Very good. Maybe we'll turn our attention to the men's form of the game now. And I saw some pictures actually came out of Moeen Ali and Alistair Cook feeding some crocodiles and petting some koala bears this week. And I don't think there's anything cuter on this planet than a photo of Alistair Cook with a cuddly koala first and foremost. But I guess, you know, with the series fast approaching now, it's only 7 or 8 days away. How are you seeing how this is going to unfold? I mean, I noticed that Moeen Ali had scared eyes with that crocodile. Is he going to be scared facing Cummins on a green top at the Gabba?
Oh, I'd be more scared facing Mitchell Starc, to be honest. But having said that, they bowl pretty rapidly. I mean, there's so much hot air going into the Ashes. It's actually ridiculous. and it happens every time round. And you know what? It gets to the point where when the first ball's bowled, it's an anti-climax. It's like Christmas. Like, the best bit is the build-up. And then this stuff happens, and you're just like, do I have to be here? Do I have to go through this again? You know, also, the other thing is, right, you're going on about England's cricket team not perhaps having the best pedigree right now. But Australia aren't that great either.
Hang on.
You know, it's only a year ago where, honestly, all I saw across social media, across the newspapers, was this is the death of Australian cricket when you lot inside 3 days to Africa and half their team are already playing in England under Colpack deals. Yeah, I mean, it's 365 days since then. You've got an opener, Matt Renshaw, right, who I think is cracking. He's also English, let's be honest. who's got a test average of 35.
Good point.
And yet, because he hasn't scored a few runs in the Sheffield Shield, again, another competition named after a place in England, everyone's going a bit nuts. And then to even be considering Matthew Wade behind the stumps, I honestly think it's only because he can say... Or was it nice, Gary? How can Phil Neville be overlooked? He's the best keeper, one of the best keepers in the world. I think Australia having the heebie-jeebies. I just don't think the English media have really latched onto it. And besides, Chris Wilks has got a 6 foot and he looks like a bloody Adonis. What more can you want?
Izzy, that is Fantastic.
That is
I love that.
Are you rig-based saying selection.
Is Chris Woakes a rig-based selection? I actually haven't...
A rig-based selection?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I mean, I always... From the moment I saw Shane Watson posing in that Lord's changing room, I feel as though rig-based selection is the only way to go. Chris Woakes is up there.
Oh, fantastic. Izzy, I think you've lit the fuse on the series as much as you were talking about hot air. I think you've actually lit the fuse.
I mean, let me just caveat that with. I mean, I still think we're going to get smashed, but you've got to have a bit of chat before.
I hope you'd consider coming back onto the Great Cricketer podcast so we can continue this kind of tete-a-tete over Australia versus England, because normally on the show we're reasonably self-loathing, but there's something about this that makes me fire up about Australia. I think we're going to smash it too.
Oh, here you go. You just followed me. That's kind of you. No, I was beforehand. Now you do that.
That's good.
No idea.
This is good. Izzy, that'll now feels like I'm cutting it off, but I'm not at all. It's just kind of coming to the end. Yeah. I really
enjoy. Do you want a spade? I'll hand you a spade. Yeah. Keep digging.
Yeah, no, I've done well this one. But all that aside, and your professionalism and my mediocrity aside, thank you very much for joining us for a couple of minutes on the Great Cricketer. That was very funny.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, shit.
Pleasure.
I don't play cricket for results. I don't come to take wickets, score runs, or win games. I play cricket to look good. Rigs, chests, pipes, circuits, salads. This is my domain. So when I hit the sheds, I need to radiate success. That's why I use Chop King Cologne by TGC. With a blend of the finest handcrafted English willow and Kookaburra Red King leather, Chop King Cologne lets me radiate cricket. Whatever the ground, whatever the circuit. Chop King Cologne. The new fragrance for men by TGC. Reek of runs without hitting them.
Well, lads, we are venturing into a very serious territory here. When we trumpeted the announcement of our next guest on the pod this week, boys, I noticed a response from one guy who merely put up a large picture of Jeffrey Boycott, and its title was Forward Defence, and he wrote, "Get ready for plenty of this, boys." So I say challenge accepted, mainly because we don't bowl line and length, if you follow the metaphor poorly. But look, with 4 first-class matches for Victoria, 9 List A appearances and 3 first-grade premierships in the pre-My Cricket era, he's probably the lowest-profile cricketer we've had on. But then again, he's the boss of all cricket, the ultimate boss of all cricket in Australia, and thus the ultimate club president. I'm talking, of course, about head honcho of Cricket Australia, CEO James Sutherland. James, welcome to the Great Cricketer, and why did you agree to do this?
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me, and what a compliment to my batting to be compared with Jeff Boycott.
We'd like to get our guests on side early.
Yeah.
Yes, if only I had a forward defence as good as Jeff Boycott.
Well said. Interesting start. James, we always start the same way, regardless of who we're speaking to. This is the Grade Cricketer after all. What is your relationship to Grade Cricket, particularly from a playing point of view?
Look, I think I can say undoubtedly the time of my life. I have the fondest memories of my involvement in the game from my grade cricket days, and particularly playing at Melbourne. I played a lot at Melbourne University and a little bit less at Melbourne, but they were great times, and I was fortunate enough to play in a few premierships, and indeed I was coach of a grade club. I was coach of University for 5 years as well, so I've heard all the excuses in the book as to why someone might not turn up at training.
James, who were the kind of characters at the club that still stick in your memory when you joined the club all those years ago as a young man? Is there any kind of characters that welcomed you in with open arms and still stick in the memory?
Yeah, I came from Melbourne in those days the rules were that if you were a student at Melbourne University you had to play at Melbourne University. So I was a recruit with some sort of background, having played a couple of seasons at Melbourne previously, and I was sort of welcomed as a high potential recruit to university. Mm. University traditionally were an underperformer, but fortunately at the time I came, a number of other good cricketers arrived at the club, and we had a new coach, and I was certainly introduced to the game and the club with open arms, and certainly happy memories of those early days there at the club. And we actually played finals in that first year, so I learned a lot. But I did recall a now doctor surgeon by the name of Ian Holton, who was someone who was a bit of a star player at the club at the time. And I remember a pre-season trip where I was introduced to what Melbourne University Cricket Club might be all about, and I have fun memories of that weekend, and staying at Ian Holton's place down at the beach was a very amusing weekend, and he didn't disappoint as an entertainer, and he's now a very responsible surgeon, I might add.
It's a lot of questions that we have off the back of that, but we'll probably just try and move on in the interest of time.
James, it says unreliably, I'm sure, on Crick Info that you played 17 seasons at Melbourne University, rather, and you're now a life member. Are all of those things true to start with?
I think 17 might be overplaying it a bit, but I played, it must have been 10 or 12 seasons, I would say, at university. My last five of them as coach, and so something like that, and I probably 5 years or something like that at Melbourne. I think three maybe as a student, a secondary school student, and then a couple of years I came back.
So it's obviously been yours,
a senior player.
You've obviously had quite a relationship with grade cricket over the years, and now you're sort of running the whole ship. I mean, have you seen a significant change in grade cricket from when you your very first day starting playing all the way through to now? Are you seeing a big shift in grade cricket?
Look, I think the game continues to evolve and change, doesn't it? But at the same, I've actually got two kids now that are playing grade cricket, so I've sort of gone full cycle. I've got an 18-year-old son and a 16-year-old daughter, both who are playing grade cricket in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And so I'm pretty close to the grade scene, and obviously university. And in many respects, it is always changing, but in other ways, it's always remaining the same.
So, James, you just mentioned your two kids there. Son Will, obviously a huge player of promise, and your daughter Annabelle, a WBBL player herself, and you a former state player, and Will, of course, the current CEO of Cricket Australia. I'm just wondering if your wife is a cricket fan, because I really hope she is.
My wife, Heidi, is a converted cricket fan. She has been known to say to me at times, "All your kids love cricket and it's all your fault." but to her credit, she's a great supporter of all of us in our cricketing pursuits, and particularly the kids. And so much so, I might add, that she's currently on the committee of the Paran Cricket Club. So she is well and truly converted.
Very good. I remember I grew up, and my brother was a few years younger than me, and we were definitely a big cricketing household, and my mum had no background in cricket, so we created a diagram that we put on the fridge of all the fielding positions, so she had to learn how to understand the game, and we used to quiz her at dinner time about the fielding positions, and she really enjoyed that. Really brought us together.
Yeah, I'll bet she did. I'm not sure Heidi would enjoy that exercise so much, or that she would go terribly well on it. But she's doing a great job for Paran Cricket Club, and very much encouraging them as a club that grows cricket as a sport for girls as well.
James, let's move forward to your administration and Test cricket, and you know we're going to have a go at talking about international affairs here. But can you sort of crystal ball us, James, what you think Test cricket will look like in 15 years, at least in your perfect world? We understand there's a Test Championship coming up, etc. But you know, can you tell our listeners out there what they could expect from Test cricket in sort of 10 to 15 years?
Yeah, it's a good question, isn't it? I mean, there's so much, in many ways, there's so much doubt about Test cricket and its future. I think in some parts of the world, it really is in a desperate state, and that's partly because it's just not commercially viable. I think there are some really significant warning signals in some parts of the world, and, you know, as a starting point, if you go to India, the country where... you know, that is supposedly the most lucrative commercial market. The valuation, the current valuations on a Test match, 5 days of Test cricket, is exactly the same as the valuation on a 3-hour T20 international match. So that's a perspective on what the market in the biggest country in the cricketing world sees the value of Test cricket, and that has a significant impact on flow-on impact to other countries. So the alarm bells are ringing for Test cricket, and that's one of the reasons why I think this context around Test cricket is so important with this league championship. And so coming back to the point, 15 years time, I sincerely hope that this league will create extra relevance and drive and importance for Test cricket. Ideally, the championship has significant incentives for countries and players to stay involved in Test cricket, and the rewards from that and the recognition from that will also be seen and reflected in fans coming continuing to stay connected to the game.
I mean, what makes you think that the championship will be such a commercial success? Because I mean, and I'm interested, just, you know, you're an accountant, in accounting terms, if Test cricket was like a standalone P&L, does it actually make money? And if so, or well, I presume not, but what makes the Test Championship likely to make money? How is it going to generate more revenues?
Well, I think, I mean, money, you know, money is basically a function of fan interest and support. And I think there's, you know, there's a lot of a romantic connection to Test cricket, and rightly so. But Test cricket has to remain relevant and contemporary for the modern day fan, and I think it's challenged by the fact that there are two other forms of the game that are alternatives. So so there's that context and relevance is particularly important, and I don't think there's any silver bullet solution. So I'm not suggesting it's that, but it's another reason why we've been very strong in trying to introduce day night Test cricket, to time shift it into a more popular hour for, or a more available hour for fans to engage with cricket. And I think there are other things that need to be looked at, including wickets, including pitches, to ensure that there is a better balance between bat and ball. And what I'm talking about there is actually giving more advantage to the bowler in Test cricket to make the game more interesting, because the one-day game and the T20 game, are, in terms of pitches and conditions, are heavily in favour of the batsman. And I think to even that up a little bit for the bowler will make for more compelling Test cricket.
So just on to Test cricket, I mean, we had the first women's Test match in 2.5 years anywhere in the world at North Sydney Oval over the weekend, just gone. Is that purely on a commercial basis that there hasn't been any other women's Test matches in the last 2.5 years, or is there something else?
Well, not just commercial. I think it's commercial as in revenue cost. I think it's all also more about public interest. You know, we were delighted with the crowds for the Test match, but in other aspects, there was some fantastic batting achievements. But over whatever it was, 400 overs, there were there were 21 wickets for the game, and the run rate was relatively slow. There were probably a whole lot of conducive factors to that outcome, but I think that world cricket, ICC and member countries have decided that the best format by which to promote the women's game is the T20 format, mm-hmm. and that's the primary format. And we continue to hold in the men's side Test cricket as you know the primary format in the game that we want to preserve and make the ultimate form. And it comes back to the question and discussion before about Test cricket. But I think we won't see a lot more women's Test cricket in the future. But hopefully, it will continue to be a part of the Ashes at least.
That's excuse me, James. So that's excellent, and cheers for that, and cheers for listening to us try and do our best, Barry Cassidy, on all of these questions here. But while we are in that vein, and while we do have you, like, it would be remiss not to ask about the Stokes affair, and it is serious. I'm curious about your view on it from an organisational perspective. And this is kind of my premise, you might dispute it, but I sense some groundwork is being laid from English cricket to prepare us for the idea that if the police don't lay charges, and we know it's a police matter, then, you know, as their as your counterpart, the ECB chief, Tom Harrison, said, Ben could rehabilitate his reputation on the field. And so while we don't know everything, do you have a view about the role of organisations independently disciplining and supporting its playing staff once the law has had its way?
I can relate to those comments from Tom. I don't know. I mean, we can read between the lines on what he's saying in terms of that rehabilitation. But I think that there are examples over time where our players have been in trouble, and that creates an opportunity for development and growth, and for them not to make the same mistake again. And there are probably numerous examples over history of Australian players in that scenario. So. I'm not sure exactly whether we're bracing ourselves for Stokes to play in the Ashes if he's not charged. But whatever the case may be, it's a difficult situation, no doubt, for ECB. And I'm glad I'm not in Tom Harrison's shoes on this one.
I appreciate that. James, we'll move on to something far less solemn than that, which is our throwdowns section. No doubt you're a huge listener to the Grey Cricketer podcast, so you'll be completely familiar with this whole format. But throwdowns, as you know, can sometimes be wonderful full tosses that you smash back at the bowler. You can want to have them for a very long time. Other times they can be yorkers, or they can be at your head and slip out of your hands. We're going to ask questions to you which essentially are selfish because the joke is wrapped up in the question, but let's see how you go with them anyway. Are you ready?
I hope so. Half volleys or just full?
We'll see. We might.
You don't know what you're going to get. That's the beauty of the throwdown.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Oh, I think I'll start off softly. James, a few weeks ago, Pat Cummins came onto this show and announced that the entire Australian fast bowling brigade would be donning moustaches, both in support of Movember and to pretend to be Mitchell Johnson. Can you announce to the country that you won't be doing that this year, given that unfortunately for you, and it's not your fault because it's predetermined, like I'm bald, for example, I wouldn't choose to be, you are only capable of a dirty Sanchez moustache?
Yes, correct. I'm not joining up to Movember this year, and I think that's a good thing. It wasn't a good look, and as you may recall, we actually had a bad time of it in Hobart last year, which coincided with the early stages of my moustache, and it seems as though every time I've photographed in the paper ever since. ridiculous look.
That's what I was going to say, James, like, with respect, when I click onto media sites, etc., if I see a picture of you with a moustache, I immediately know it's going to be a critical piece about you because the sub-editor's probably just gone, well, let's pull out the moustache pick.
Yeah, that's right.
Clearly funny for you.
It might have been 1,000 photos taken in the past, but there's about 3 of them with me with a moustache, and they're the ones I use the whole time.
Moving along, James. So you're a qualified accountant and a former professional cricketer, a bowler with a first-class average of 39.7. How far did you round this down when interviewing for the job at Cricket Australia?
Every bit counts, doesn't it?
Always the one, mate.
James, do you have the power to make a baggy green, and can I have one?
They're locked away downstairs in storage. What would your offer be?
Just to receive it
for free.
He wasn't expecting a follow up.
Oh, I think you probably want to put a better offer across the table than that.
I've just got one on that, James. Given your administrators and you know where they're locked up and stuff, I mean, can you tell the nation today that, or at least answer this question? I mean, do you guys have it? You and Pat Howard, etc. Do you ever just sort of secretly go down there and put them on? Sort of maybe 8:30 at night or something. Everyone's out. Sit there, maybe a glass of scotch or something. Yeah.
Well, there's actually a mirror down there, so we can actually not only put it on, but we can see ourselves with it on. So it's
why are you naked?
We probably only do it once a week, but yeah, it's still good fun.
James, when you eventually get a gig running the ICC, do you plan on greeting your former CA colleagues at functions with zero eye contact, staring blankly over their shoulders as if you've ever known them?
Depends on whether they're voting for the resolutions or the recommendations that I'm putting forward at the time.
Let's say they are.
what Dave wants to know is, do you ever get champed by the BCCI?
Yes.
James, just back to kind of grade matters. So I just looked at your player profile on Crick Info, and it, in the current climate where behaviour off the field is almost as under the microscope as behaviour on it, I was surprised to read your player bio on Crick Info, which says James Sutherland was a medium-fast bowler who became a versatile off-field all-rounder. It certainly raised my eyebrows. As a cricketer, how important is it to be as versatile off the field as you are on it?
I guess you've got to try, but my versatility on the field wasn't terribly good. I was definitely not an all rounder on the field. I'm actually trying to be an all rounder now because I'm back playing this year with our 13 year old son, and that's quite an experience after 5 years out of the game.
Very good. James, the past 12 months has seen a raft of issues, the controversial collective bargaining dispute, scheduling, on-field results, existential concerns over the national selection process. So what do you think about Warnie as the next Bachelor?
That would be a great show, wouldn't it? I'm looking forward to it as a former teammate of Shane's. I think he'd be great. We've seen him in the jungle, and that's the time. I think the ratings would be a real burn.
James, you're doing well here, enduring this. Some years ago, it was brought to our attention that Sydney grade cricket intended to fall in line with the rest of the country, who'd rebranded to Premier Cricket. We considered as a trio penning a comprehensive submission outlining the reasons why the original title should remain, not least because everyone knows there's nothing premier about driving on a motorway every Saturday to play against 20-year-olds who sledge you relentlessly while you fail both on the field and at home because you're not progressing your life. Did you rebrand grade cricket to Premier Cricket in a desperate bid to delegitimise the grade cricketer?
What's he going to say to that?
Definitely not, but you guys seem to be going pretty well. I think your brand seems to be pretty well intact and growing by the season, so I don't think the rebranding to Premier Cricket is having any impact on you. We all know what you're talking about.
I don't know what to do with compliments.
Incidentally, I was sledged on the weekend, it was the team that we played against was just constantly running sort of MOU type banter at me the whole time while I batted.
You got any examples?
Dispute ball and things like that. I was batting with my 13-year-old son at the time, and he hasn't played a lot of senior cricket and hasn't heard a lot of banter or sledging or anything like that. But after we had batted and after he went out after me and he came and sat with me and he said, "Geez, Dad, aren't they a bunch of flogs?"
Using the patent word flog as well, which is very prominent in grade cricket. Yeah. Very good.
James, what's Pat Howard like?
Pat's a great guy, actually. He's a fantastic bloke to work with, and certainly he's got a difficult job because he oversees our whole team performance function. But an outstanding bloke to work with, and whilst he's got difficult decisions to make and is pushing change and performance outcomes all the time, I've got the highest regard for him, and would say that of all the people that I've worked with in sport, I've never known anyone to be more accountable and more keen to win.
Oh, that's a wonderful tribute, James. We might get to the last one. Dave, do you have another one as well?
Maybe after you, mate.
Okay. No, very good. Okay, well, I was just going to say, James, again, it's just a completely unfair question, but as we go to air, we don't know what the test side is. It's likely that you know something about the test side. So just to make it easy on you, if I ask whether Matt Renshaw's in, just say nothing. And if Cameron Bancroft's in, start talking.
We won't edit this in post. Yeah.
All right. Okay, I've got it. Understood.
Did you just whisper Jake Lehman?
Yeah.
Baby Boof. I'm pretty sure I heard that.
It's unfair.
Yeah, I'll leave that with you boys.
We'll leave it there, I reckon. I think I've exhausted my throwdowns for now.
James, boys. Thank you for being such a good sport dealing with these selfish questions, but also giving us a great deal of insight into your thinking on the future of cricket and everything else wrapped up within that. And it was great to learn that you could actually play the game and were a teammate of Shane Warne's as well. I think that was a nice one to drop in.
Mm. Yeah, thanks, guys. Appreciate your time. Keep up the good work.
Cheers, James.
Thanks, mate.
It has been referred to as the best sports writing tribute to a particular sport since Fever Pitch.
Does it do anything to enhance literature? Would be another question.
I wouldn't even call it literature, really.
That time of the week again, hashtag AskTGC. It was absolutely fantastic to speak to both Izzy Westbury and, of course, James Sutherland. Some of those throwdowns were outrageous, ridiculous, and we hope you enjoyed at least some of them, if not all of them.
We just missed the opportunity, he goes, to call him Southo. I think that's a really bad missed opportunity from us.
Can we call him back now? Let's call him back. All right, let's get straight into it. Armchair Expert 17 says... Just picked up Teen No Sympathy, keen to get stuck in, but I never read the first one. Do I need to, or can I jump straight in?
Yeah, you need to. Because we need money. So, definitely get it, read it in a day, and then get the second one without a doubt. But also don't if you don't want to.
I mean, even if you haven't read a single book in your life, I think you'll be fine starting with Teen No Sympathy. I think you'll be able to pick up. I mean, the book does pick up where the last one left off, but you'll be right, mate. Just go ahead and read, and you'll find your rhythm.
Please give us all the royalties. DM asks, "Hey, great cricketer, just read your book, and it made me hate cricket and humanity." Question: why do you use imperial units of measure? Is this an alpha thing, and you think it's tougher than metric, or are you going for the US market?
Both. To be honest, I think that's a really good question. I hadn't thought about it.
Could we make it in America? I mean, we've seen how successful Paul Hogan, Steve Irwin have been over there. Do you reckon Americans would embrace niche cricket jokes, or would we have to customise our content to kind of capture that market share in the States? Could we adopt the franchise model, like the rec league basketballer?
It's all great questions all.
Andrew Leslie, he writes in, AskTGC, could grade cricketer's rising notoriety actually be leading to ill-informed journalists using the term grade cricket in order to gain more clicks for bizarre stories from park cricket? Put another way, could you guys actually be part of the problem? This is actually a very interesting question, Andre Leslie, fantastic question. What are you guys' thoughts?
Yeah, it's a Beatles effect, without a doubt. We've become bigger than Jesus, and now people are kind of latching onto our brand to get clicks from articles, without a shadow of a doubt, the Beatles effect.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Andre there. I mean, I won't mention the publications or the companies involved, but I have seen a proliferation of grade cricket mentions in the media lately, and it's obviously an attempt to leverage the fame that we've got from being a, you know, 1/3 of Twitter account each, respectively. But I think whenever grade cricket is mentioned, it's always in relation to some terrible park standard game where some right really bloated bloke has taken like a triple hat trick or belted 400 runs in a session or something, which obviously never happens in Sydney Test cricket. So, yeah.
Is everyone morbidly obese in park cricket?
Seems it.
You never see a rig in park cricket.
Boys said that.
Like, you never see a rig in park cricket.
Mm. And I'd love to see more of a rigging park cricket. Can I ask the listeners, actually, if you do ever see poorly attributed labels of cricket, if you do see park cricket labelled grade cricket, please get in touch and we'll see what we can do.
Evan Dix asks, having been exiled to Melbourne after quitting Sydney grade cricket, I find myself back in the harbour city for a conference. The social function is at Cargo Lounge. How should one proceed, Evan? Fantastic question.
He goes, you'd be in a good position to answer this, I'd imagine.
Stalwart of Cargo.
I would suggest that I've been to Cargo Lounge roughly 200 times in my life.
Just the lounge, though. I went there. Not the bar, the lounge.
Is there a downstairs?
Is there any more? Is there actually any more?
Well, it reopened last weekend. Isn't that the bathroom?
You wouldn't be there. There's no social currency coins. There.
I'm not sure if we've asked if we answered Evan's question there, but it is actually the home of Sydney Circuit Cricket. That doesn't make any sense.
Sydney Cricket Circuit.
Go with it though. Own it.
Yeah, Lord, I think in a roundabout way we have answered the question, because it really just precipitates a whole bunch of words around whether there was an upstairs or a downstairs ever at Cargo, because Cargo is his place on Cockle Bay Wharf in Sydney's harbour. That's where everyone from Sydney grade cricket went. And the downstairs was for the plebs, like the lower grades, and the upstairs was for the first graders. And when you're upstairs, you felt $1 million or $100, which is the maximum amount of money I'd ever have.
I should also say that I actually have seen numerous Test cricketers in that bar after a Test match, and also just on a Friday night.
I used to see a lot of Test cricketers and rugby union players in Wallaby Bar in circa 2003 to 2004. That was really where I saw most of my.
What would the equivalent cricket bar be called? Like the Baggy Green Bar or something? Or would you go to a bar called the First Grade Bar?
There's so many cricketers' arms, but they don't really have cricket in them. Like there would be good if there was a grade cricket specific bar, but then you'd say that every club has one of those.
I'm pretty sure it's Cargo. Word of the Lord writes in. He says, imagine, if you will, being consistently champed by your wife while playing backyard cricket because she can bat and bowl better than you. Would this be a turn on or an erosion of your manhood? What would your dad have to say on the matter?
There's a lot to unpack
this
there.
This is in relation to Elise Perry, because he's used the hashtag Elise Perry and also Ask TJC.
Well, I mean, we're going to have to, speaking of Wallabies, we're going to have to get Matt Tamua on, Elise Perry's partner, possibly husband, fiancé.
Yes.
He's probably experienced
perfect
exactly
partners.
This. Yeah.
Perfect partners, the old footy show segment.
More passion in your voice there than the previous two series of the Great Cricket Podcast. Yeah, let's ask Matt Tamua.
Yeah, let's get Matt Tamura on. I think, look, if you're spending all your time playing backyard cricket with your wife and getting dominated, no less, then you obviously have a very dysfunctional marriage and your dad wouldn't be impressed at all.
Simple.
I mean, Christmas is around the corner. There's going to be a lot of backyard ashes being played, so it's a very relevant question. Last one of the week, chaps. Some Sports Nuffy again, who we had on last week, he's just screenshotted one of his notes, and he said, word got back to my folks that I was closing on a ton on Saturday. So shocked that I was getting runs 2 weeks in a row. They came down together as a couple. First thing they'd done together in a while. Mum sat on the hill with the dog while Dad proceeded to get blind with the old boys watching along. When I was dismissed, Mum left and Dad stayed to drink on. Am I keeping this marriage alive? And if I fail, is it doomed? Hashtag RTGC.
First thing they've done together in a while. It's great this detail hasn't gone unnoticed.
I want to think of, yeah, I mean, the thought process is when he plays and misses at one, you know, like his teammates will yell out, work hard, and he'll be thinking, I bloody well am. You know, I'm really trying to keep this family together. Like, believe me, I'm working hard, you know, tears streaming down his face as he hits a cover drive for two. That's another couple of years together.
It's just like, yeah, just like a third slips moves in, and the captain from like mid on goes, a lot of pressure on this bloke now, and they have no idea how much pressure actually is on him.
No idea. Like, absolutely. We talk a lot about how cricket destroys marriages, but this is a rare example of the opposite. Cricket to save a marriage. Jeez, that's a lot of pressure at the crease.
Chaps, what a wonderful show this has been. Thank you as ever so much for your company. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can follow us on all of them if you so wish. We very much appreciate your time tuning into this each week. Anything else? What are we selling? We're flogging a book, Tea and No Sympathy. That's still out there. Mm. Actually, last week we talked about the podcast and we received a lot of positive reviews. So thank you so much for doing that. As ever, we love doing this. We can't wait for next week already. The Ashes, it's 7 days away. Get ready.